my team, we never did really find that script, so we couldn't really stay on the script.
Sarah Palin begins her national book tour from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 16th of November. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Juneau residents recover from a massive mudslide that displaced dozens of people.
And there was this big wall of mud coming in and busting through the window.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
Juneau residents displaced by this weekend's landslides will stay in hotel rooms through the weekend. About 80 residents of downtown Juneau were allowed to return to their homes Sunday afternoon, but 8 people are still homeless. Heavy rain and winds battered the hillside above Gastineau Avenue overnight Friday, loosening soil and sending trees, mud, and other debris down onto the street. One of the slides crashed into the Strasbo apartment building where Juliana Pop lives.
I just heard this loud crack, and I thought it was a tree. The next thing I know, I hear this splintering sound like shattering glass, and then I went back to my bedroom where I sleep, and there was this big wall of mud coming in and busting through the window.
The city and Red Cross established a shelter at Centennial Hall where at least 25 people spent the night. Others stayed with family and friends or at hotels. Snow and freezing temperatures overnight Saturday helped stabilize the hillside. After inspecting the area Sunday morning, experts said it was safe enough for residents to begin returning. But the cleanup effort will continue for at least the rest of this week. Meanwhile, the Red Cross is helping 8 people who live in the Strasbo apartments find long-term housing. The building might have structural damage and residents won't be allowed to return until an engineer says it's safe. But the Gastineau Humane Society was able to retrieve people's pets. That was really important to Jackie Allen, who lives in the Channelview apartments on Gastineau with her granddaughter and several animals.
I have 2 cats, a rat, and 2 fish. And they're just fine. The guy from, he was like Red Cross Humane Society helper, and he checked on my animals all through the night and took care of them, fed them, watered them, petted them, loved on them.
Housing First is a nonprofit that provides low-income housing and owns the Strasbo apartments damaged by mud, trees, and other debris from the slides. Board Chair Jennifer Klein says they're working with their insurance company to see if repairs can be made as soon as possible. In the meantime, they're trying to find long-term affordable housing for their displaced tenants.
We have an empty apartment at our other site over in Douglas, Hillview. And so one of the tenants is planned to move over there, so that's one of the, I believe, 7 that we can take care of right away. And then our property manager, Trevor, has been calling all around to look for some other long-term housing that might work out for people.
Mueller says the Red Cross is also providing hotel rooms to a handful of homeless people who were camping on the hill where the landslides occurred. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin launches a massive publicity blitz today, and the national media is gobbling it up. Palin appeared on a pre-taped episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show this afternoon to promote her new book, Going Rogue, An American Life, which hits bookstands tomorrow. Today on Oprah, Palin opened up about flattering and unflattering moments on the vice presidential campaign trail.
Let's talk about the interview with Katie Kirk.
Must we?
Yeah.
Okay.
You talk about in the book, so I assume everything in the book is fair game to
it. Is.
You say in the book that you thought that Katie Kirk had a partisan agenda. And did you think that she was, you know, had a partisan political agenda or some other agenda?
Well, I think that her agenda was to not necessarily show me in the best light.
As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the national fascination with Alaska's former governor is booming.
She may be Governor Palin or even Sarah to many Alaskans, but in Washington, D.C. and throughout much of the country, Sarah Palin is again this week's It Girl. On Oprah, MSNBC, the cover of Newsweek, everywhere.
Today, all new, the world exclusive, Oprah and former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin.
The campaign, you write about being told how to dress and what to say and even what to eat.
Is Sarah Palin positioning herself for 2012 or just settling scores and selling books?
The increasingly personal war of words is all related to Palin's claims in her book Going Rogue that hits shelves tomorrow.
Palin's book has been atop national bestseller lists for weeks from pre-sales, and she starts her book tour Wednesday, steering clear of the typical major metropolitan areas such tours usually hit. Instead, she's going to places like Washington, Pennsylvania, Columbus, Ohio, and Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's where she finds her strongest fan base. University of Alaska Fairbanks political science professor Jerry Macbeth says she appeals to a specific swath of America.
It's basically a value issue. The extent to which she resonates with conservative and religious Americans. However inconsistent, you know, she might be in any of the conservative issues we would look at, she's able to reach people there and speak to them.
Macbeth says there are a host of reasons Palin still generates such fanfare. She comes from a place most Americans think is exotic. She's a popular personality. But the biggest thing, says Macbeth, is that Palin fills a vacuum.
The main background factor is that there just isn't a real strong conservative leader right now in the United States.
Where Palin will eventually fit in the national political landscape is still unclear. Larry Sabato is the well-known and often quoted director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Sabato describes an almost fairy tale nature to her story.
It's a combination of an unusual and interesting personality and the mix of national politics. Now, the irony is Sarah Palin is the celebrity she is today because John McCain picked her out of obscurity to be his vice presidential candidate. Of course, much of her book is attacking the McCain campaign.
Alaskans may bristle at the idea of their governor being plucked from obscurity. Regardless, Sabato says Palin's book is already backfiring on her in Washington, and he calls it inconceivable that Americans would elect someone president who resigned in the middle of her only term in statewide office. And Sabato says Republican operatives and elites in the Beltway doubt her ability to win the presidency in 2012.
What she has demonstrated to them is that she's probably not ready to be president. She may never be ready to be president. And she's not ready to be a nominee without bringing with her a cast of characters that can only be described as an Alaska soap opera.
But the down-home nature of her personal story is part of what helps her appeal to many Americans, says writer Patrick Gavin, who reports for the newspaper and website Politico.
Somebody who may not quite get the White House, but seems to, in a lot of ways, almost have as much of a bully pulpit as the White House does. I mean, as a lot of conservatives will point out, I mean, Sarah Palin can do more on a Facebook update to affect the health care debate than almost anybody else. And to some extent, that's true.
Gavin says D.C. insiders are fascinated with Palin's ability to connect with people outside Washington.
I think that for sure, people in Washington are more interested because we're a more political town than elsewhere. I think that Sarah Palin, in general, to a lot of Washington insiders who are probably more practical when it comes to campaigns and perhaps less emotional, find her to be fascinating. I think that part of Sarah Palin's appeal to a lot of her supporters is an emotional appeal.
Palin's book tour locations have been announced until Thanksgiving, and no Alaska stops have been named yet. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Although the outside world may be turning somersaults over Sarah Palin's Going Rogue, Alaska Democrats are using the book hype to boost their launch of a website, aimed at holding Mrs. Palin accountable. Kevin Harran is communications director for the Alaska Democratic Party.
We have this new website. It's called sarahwatch.org. And basically, it's to look at some of the myths and the fact and fiction of some of the things that Sarah Palin has done as governor and also as a candidate for national office.
Harran says the Democrats put in an information request regarding emails that Palin sent while she was governor of Alaska, but so far there has been little response.
And they said, well, it's going to be very difficult to get the information. It might cost $500,000. I mean, all sorts of things. And we just want to know, where is it? And the latest letter we got back from the attorney general said that they were, you know, still trying to put them together or to see what it would cost to put them together.
Alaska Democratic Party Chair Patty Higgins says she wants to know what then-Governor Palin had done on several issues. Since it was made public that while governor, Palin was using both government and private email accounts, Higgins wrote to the state administration in September of last year asking for all schedules and itineraries of former Governor Palin from January 1st of 2007 through mid-September of 2008, and for all emails between Palin and John Coghill and Fred Dyson during that time period that contained certain references. Higgins also wants email from the former governor to her husband Todd Palin and to Molly McCann during the same time frame, emails that contain one or more of 20 key words. Harran was not specific as to which issues the Democrats are seeking to shed light on, except to mention the Troopergate incident, in which Palin, while governor, was criticized for her actions in firing then Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monagan.
The state government has a responsibility when citizens ask for something under the Open Records Act to produce it within a reasonable amount of time at a reasonable cost. And this case is just a stonewall.
Harran says the Sarah Watch website is designed to be a watchdog as Sarah Palin takes stage center yet again. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new chief curator promises to keep Alaska's heritage safe.
Our mission is to serve the institutions of the state, so we have been pushing that extensively, and it's much better than it used to be.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at Primera.com. Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at RedDogAlaska.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
Federal Gas Pipeline Coordinator Drew Pierce resigned her position this morning at the request of the White House. Pierce opened the office for the Bush administration in 2006. In her letter of resignation to President Obama, Pierce reminded him of the importance of Alaska's gas, saying it is essential to the nation's energy and economic security. The White House released a statement thanking Pierce for her service. White House spokesman Adam Abrams says the president, quote, values the office of the federal coordinator and the important role that it plays in promoting our nation's energy security. Governor Parnell said Pierce has been very important to the state in the coordinator's office, and he is concerned the state will lose ground without her experience working on the gas line issue.
The federal government is obviously a significant landowner in Alaska, and we need a person familiar with Alaska, as well as familiar with how to navigate federal agencies when it comes to moving a gas pipeline forward. So Drew has that experience. She has that background. I think you know, it's a tremendous loss there.
Parnell says there was no contact with the state in advance of the job opening, nor has anyone asked for recommendations on her replacement. Senators Murkowski and Begich were both consulted in advance of the call for Pierce to resign and were asked about her replacement. In a press release today, Senator Begich also commended the president for, quote, bringing new energy to the office. Larry Persily, a former employee of the state's Washington, D.C. office and currently a legislative employee who specializes in gas line issues, says the project federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas gives the state and the gas line project another voice in the nation's capital.
There's a lot of work to do in the regulatory process with federal agencies, talking with Canadian counterparts, working with Congress to answer questions, getting out information. You know, this is a massive project. People have talked about it for 40 years. We've been dreaming about it for 40 years. So there's no shortage of work to do on it.
Neither the governor nor Persily have had any indication of change to the focus on the job, the gas line, or the federal interest in getting Alaska's gas to market. Until a new coordinator is made public, Admiral Thomas Barrett will step up from his current role as deputy federal coordinator. Pierce, a former legislator and president of the state Senate, is unavailable, traveling to Alaska today to attend events in Fairbanks and Anchorage. She leaves her position on January 3rd. It looks like it could be another below-average pink salmon season next summer in southeast Alaska. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is forecasting a region-wide catch of 19 million humpies for next year. That harvest would be just under half of the annual average for the past decade, KFSK's Jovic Nicky reports.
The 2010 forecast is based on past trends in the southeast pink salmon catch, along with National Marine Fisheries Service 2009 survey data of juvenile pink salmon in the northern part of the region.
Ironically, 19 million is the same number that we forecast for the 2008 season. So this is very similar.
That's Bill Davidson, Fish and Game's Regional Salmon Management Coordinator. He says the state's forecast uses different information from another forecast from the National Marine Fisheries Service.
We differ from the NIMS forecast in that we're still weighting our forecast on recent year returns. And because of the low recent returns in 2008 and 2006, those are definitely going to have an influence on our forecast and pull the harvest estimate down.
The National Marine Fisheries Service is forecasting a higher harvest for next year at just under 27 million pink salmon. With the exception of a surprisingly low return in 2006, Fish and Game has been close with its recent pink salmon forecasts. The commercial fishing fleets caught just over 38 million pinks in 2009, just below the forecast of 41 million. In 2008, when the parents for next summer's fish were in the spawning streams, the fleet caught 16 million. The department manages purse seine fishing for pink salmon in season and decides open areas and fishing time based on the actual returns during the summer. 2008 saw especially weak runs in some areas of the northern inside waters, and Fish and Game did not meet its goals for pinks making it back to some northern southeast spawning streams. Because of that, Davidson expects to have a cautious approach on the northern end next year.
We're going to have to adjust our management not to over-harvest already weak returns and keep an eye on our escapements. And so that means some areas may not even have openings unless they show unexpected strength in returns.
That could mean the same fleet focuses again next summer on returns in southern southeast. Southeast Alaska Seiners Executive Director Bob Thorstenson says Fish and Game's forecast is not a surprise.
We don't expect a boomer. You know, we expect a pretty moderate run. In fact, I think we're not in the forecasting business, but I think we're probably looking in the 20 million range to less than 30. I think it's pretty safe to say ocean survival hasn't been the greatest, and there wasn't a single pink salmon jump north of Petersburg all the way to Glacier Bay in the parent year. The north end was a complete bust for pinks. The worst we'd seen since 1973.
Thorstenson says it will probably take some time for northern southeast pink returns to rebuild. He says it will also take some mild winters with good salmon ocean survival to see anything like the record-setting harvests of the late 1990s and first half of this decade. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. The Alaska Wounded Veterans Project, a nonprofit organization that provides assistance to veterans who were wounded both physically and psychologically during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Information at alaskastateelks.org. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
House Democrats yesterday confirmed the appointment of Neil Foster of Nome to take the place of his father, Richard, who died in office last month. Minority Leader Beth Kurtula says Foster's selection shows that the process can work well, starting in Foster's home district through the governor and to the legislature.
We had a subcommittee that met extensively with him. Many of us went to Nome, many of us know people there and have talked to a lot of people in the district, and throughout it have come away with the impression that not only is he well-liked, but also just very highly respected and a real leader.
Responding to rumors that there was pressure on Foster to become a member of the minority Democrats instead of organizing with Republicans, as his father often did, and as three current Democrats have done, Kurtula said caucus members had said they would not confirm his appointment unless he agreed to join with them.
Almost assuredly, we would not have confirmed someone who was not going to caucus with us, and we wanted to make that clear. But at the same time, it was also clear that the Nome and Unifleet Democrats, the district there, it was their choice. You know, we can't tell them, you know, how to make their own decision. We just needed to be clear about what our decision would be.
She says, to her knowledge, there was no threat to put a well-financed opponent into the primary race when Foster would run for election in his own right in August. Kurtula said the minority will meet again before next year's session to decide on any committee seats that will need to be changed. An exhibit designer with a long history in the state is the new top official for Juneau's Alaska State Museum and Sitka's Sheldon Jackson Museum. Bob Banghart was named chief curator of the State Museum System earlier this month. The longtime Juneau resident has been the State Museum's curator of exhibitions since 2007. Before that, he spent 30 years running a planning and design firm that created exhibits and consulted for museums, libraries, and cultural centers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld spoke with Banghart, who says he sees a distinct trend for museums in Alaska.
What I see more and more is an understanding that if a community is going to start an institution or reinforce an existing institution, that having it be a reflection of the community in which it resides is its absolute strength, and not try to make it into something people might want to see in an anticipatory way. You know what I mean? Is have it reflect the community, then it has a genuineness that transfers over to the visitor, to the community, and it also has a relationship with the people who live there. And the other end is there are more individuals coming out of academic programs that are moving in across the state into the various institutions, whereas prior to even a decade ago, what we were seeing mostly is just people who grew up in the system in some fashion and maybe didn't have an academic background before they got into practical. And mostly people started out doing what they could do and stayed in that arena. So there's a little shift. It's very subtle in certain respects, but it is a maturation of the industry in the state, and I kind of can foresee that continuing, if not strengthening, as we get into these next generations of service providers, educated and experienced in other institutions, and bring a little bit a wider viewpoint to the equation, which is kind of interesting.
What about issues or problems with preserving what's already there? I know, at least in the past, some of the smaller museums have just had a real hard time keeping up with the technology and facilities to keep what they have in good shape.
You know, with that broadening of the knowledge base with management and people who come in from various other institutions, and that, and coupled with, we got a very aggressive outreach program going out into the communities, assisting on many different levels and
collection preservation and mitigating of circumstances that might be detrimental in regard to the building and the building's atmospheres, proper handling and display technologies, storage and cataloging methodologies. So that is an undercurrent that we maintain and support pretty strongly, that our mission is to serve the institutions of the state. So we have been pushing that extensively, and it's much better than it used to be.
Are the collections of the State Museum here and the Sheldon Jackson Museum in Sitka, are they in pretty good shape?
Yeah, they are, actually. You know, I mean, we're running up against that age-old problem of running out of space to thoroughly catalog the material culture and archival materials. And but, you know, that's any successful institution is always going to be running out of space, and we've run out of space. So, I mean, there's an effort underfoot now to look at a new building that's a combined libraries, archives, and museums building. And so we've been having ongoing discussions internally and with service providers outside and of the state arena to guide us in the process of definitive examination of what we need, how we need to define the space, and then work with leadership to try to get new space on board here before it reaches an acute situation. In some respects, you know, it is, but that's only just because the building is aging.
New Chief State Museum Curator Bob Banghart takes over from Bruce Cotto, who retired in July. He spoke with Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld. In addition to the two institutions, Banghart oversees a grant and technical assistance program that helps local museums. That includes a new effort to open 5 museums in Prince William Sound. The State Museum system has 15 permanent staff, additional summer employees, and an operating budget of approximately $1.7 million. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.